I am Marilyn Slater, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for that beautiful reading, Shannon, and thank you for being the perfect host. And you set a wonderful example for me of graciousness and generosity and unselfishness, and I would love to take that pampering home. Ah, it's been so delicious and wonderful. I want to thank so many people here, and I just don't even know how to begin, because this is a wonderful weekend, beginning with the beloved Polly that I love so much, and the committee that set up this wonderful weekend, Hillary and her music, and Amanda, the voice of our conference, and all the speakers from whom I've learned so much, Lee, of course, who preserves our message. I left people out, I'm sure, and I'm sorry about that, but it's just a wonderful, wonderful weekend. It's a privilege to be here. I've been asked to consider with you steps 6 and 7, two of my favorites because they're so mystical and mysterious, and I ponder over them. Step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step 7, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. That implies that we have not taken those steps first, and it's a good idea to take the steps in order. Most sponsors will advise you to do that. And because it mentions these defects of character, so it implies that we've found those before in some other steps, and because of the wonderful talks that preceded, we learned that particularly, as Katie talked about, steps 4 and 5, reveal an awfully lot to us. It kind of changes our perspective, makes us almost believe that our troubles were of our own making. That when we feel bad, there might be something wrong with us. And so that's a step in that direction. And then 6 and 7 then says, you'd be a happier person. You might live joyous, happy, joyous, and free lives if you could discard some of those defects. That's probably what made you feel so bad all of your life and made you drink so much. And it's going to tell you how to do this. So by that time, I was convinced that I really needed a house cleaning of my character defects. And so I quickly turned to that page in our big book that will tell me exactly how to get rid of my character defects. And lo and behold, it says I can't do it. God could and would if I humbly ask for it. And living an ego-driven life with a great 7-year plan, I just thought, what does that mean? And then I read the 7th step prayer. My Creator, I am now willing that you have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And again, that's this mysterious, mystical thing. I'm asking God to take away my defects, but not all of them, just the ones that get in my way of being of use to other people. Being of a parasitic nature, selfish and self-centered, I just thought, well, do I really want this? Do I want to live a life of unselfishness, helping other people? What's in it for me? So I think I took the 7th step prayer in a half-hearted way at first, without much humility. But then I began to hear some of our great, as Shannon said, our heroes in the fellowship, the wonderful Sandy Beach that many of us knew and loved, meant so much in my sobriety at so many points. And he told a wonderful parable in 1976 out in the desert And in fact, Lee and other tapers have preserved that wonderful talk, so you can hear him talking about dropping the rock. And it really is a seventh step, sixth and seventh step kind of thing. He talked about coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and what it was like for him. This was this parable of a swimmer just out in the sea, flailing around and drowning. And he was just that swimmer. Somebody had thrown him a life preserver, but he couldn't make much headway. He was holding onto the life preserver, and something was dragging him down. And he felt like he was going to go down for the count. And then a boatload of happy people, happy AAs, came along. And they saw him out there flailing around. And they sort of knew what was wrong with him. He seemed to be carrying a great big rock with him. And they screamed, "Drop the rock!" And he thought, no, that's who I am. Because that represented all of his defects of character, the biases, the plans, the seven-year plans, the ego drive to be a success. All of those negative manifestations of self were all in that great big ball that he was carrying around. And they kept screaming, "Drop the rock." And then he used the phrase, and then something happened while he wasn't paying much attention. In other words, he didn't drop it himself, but something happened, and the rock fell away from him. And he just buoyed up like somebody on water skis, and quickly got to the boat, jumped aboard, and became one of those happy AAs that was sailing around. And sometime later, they looked out and they saw somebody flailing around in the water, and he was there yelling, "Drop the rock!" And I swear to you, I was reading the LA Times before I left home, and I brought it along with me. May 27, 2015, just a couple days ago, this article appeared. Man drowns trying to swim across pond with 10-pound rock on his 21st birthday. A little bit of the text. A Northern California man celebrating his 21st birthday drowned after attempting to swim across a pond while carrying a heavy rock, authorities said. The CHP and the Butte County Sheriff's Coroner Office are investigating his death. CHP officers said they believed alcohol played a role in his death. Drop the rock. So I heard that, and I thought, could it be that there would be joy after that? Another one of my heroes, the hero of many of us, was the great Chuck Chamberlain. And I heard him when I was new. When I came into the program as a scornful atheist, really arrogant in my disbelief. He talked about God in such a sweet way. He's the pappy and we're his kids. He said that we just look at the first line of the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father." He is our Father. He loves us. And he had such a strong presence that I listened to him. I knew that he knew something big, something beautiful. And I wanted to hear what that was, and it did seem to have some relationship to this being that he called the Father, the Pappy. And he talked about uncovering, discovering, and discarding. Discarding these character defects, these manifestations of self, the ego, death to self, he talked about, so that we could be free. And why did we need to be free? And that was, he said that, well, in fact, he said that there is only one problem that is the root of all problems, and that is conscious separation from God and from our fellows. And there's one solution that is the solution to all problems, and that is conscious contact with God and our fellows. And I believe that he was right, and I began to want what he talked about, that there could be some good in that. And I re-examined steps 6 and 7 and became more willing, more humble. And I was humbled, certainly, by the first step, admitting that, hey, I can't stop drinking and I can't stay stopped for any period of time. It's going to kill me. It's going to kill people around me. I need help. I need help. And that was an act of humility. I was not a terribly humble person before that. But I was beaten. I was beaten by alcohol. And I began to think that if I could have that same attitude, maybe that's what it's talking about. Humbly ask. And when I first came into the program, I was just bringing in all these character defects. And they were probably good in the beginning, because God, whom I've come to know and love, I think could use these character defects. And these character defects, one of which was my parasitic nature, I could just attach to you like a tick on a dog and suck out your life. And proceeded to do that with every warm mammal that came along, and most fled in terror. So I brought that defect and others into the fellowship, and it was just like a wheelbarrow full of character defects. And old-timers would come over and they'd pick a few out. Oh, we can use this one, and this is good. And one of them was this great and desperate need to attach, to get your approval. It was a funny thing that I had this need. I want you to like me. I need your approval. I want to attach. But I don't like you very much. But I did hear a woman speak at my first meeting back, the wonderful Marion Wallin, who has passed on. And I use her last name. This is in our tradition, at least on the West Coast, is that we use the full identity of those members who have gone on to the larger life. And the wonderful Marion talked. And, of course, I ran up and attached to her. And would you be my sponsor? And she agreed to be my sponsor. And that was when that defect of that desperate need for approval, that desperate dependence on another person, was used to my advantage, because I did anything and everything that she asked me to do. I just wanted so desperately to have her approve of me. And so that was a character defect that my higher power could use for my benefit. I was asked to talk early on because Marion's husband was standing in the secretary one night in our home group, and he said, would you be a 10-minute speaker? And I said, no. And he said, go talk with your sponsor about that. And I agreed to do that because I knew she would protect me. I thought that she loved me more than the other sponsees, and I hope so anyway. And so I explained the situation. I'd been asked to talk, and of course I can't. I explained to Marion, and she looked at me, and she was disappointed. And she said, oh, Marilyn, that's an AA request. We always say yes to AA requests. So I suggest that you go back and say to the secretary, I've reconsidered. I'd like to thank you for asking me to participate in my own sobriety. But wanting her approval so desperately, I did that, and I got up and I flailed around and I talked about those things that were important to me, the emotions, the only emotions, excitement, depression, anxiety, as our big book says, plagued us. That's about all I knew, and I sat down, and it was the mild, because we care. And so I ran up to Marion. How did I do? And she said, well, it was good you said yes to AA. That was good. But you've got to start mentioning that you drank. I'd forgotten that part. Because alcohol was a friend. That was the one thing that allowed me to continue on my ego-driven course and until it completely beat me down. But because she said that, I began to do that. I began to talk about drinking, and I found out that, wow, I've got a story just like most of these stories that I hear. I had a great fear of the podium, too. And yet, by saying yes for Marion's approval, I was able to do it. And little by little, I began to see that walking into these fearful situations began to alleviate some of that fear. And I began to get some insight into that mysterious seventh step, that seventh step prayer. And in fact, our book has this funny advice. It said that we, and also in the 11th step, 10th and 11th steps, it recognizes that, again, we look for our defects and we ask God to remove them. And then we go about our business of helping others. It doesn't say that we remove them. In fact, in several cases, it points out that we can't remove them. And I began to get a little bit of insight that somehow, by taking the steps, writing honest inventories, humbly asking God to remove our shortcomings, and then moving into steps 8 and 9, and then doing the maintenance steps, that somehow it might happen if I was fastly tied to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Marion, a couple of times, and other people too, have said that we will recover if we do the things that are put in front of us, that we will get exactly what we need for our recovery. But it's a two-way street. It's presented to us, we say yes, and we do it. And it seems as if miracles happen. We take up our beds and walk. We are healed of a fatal disease, alcoholism. As long as we do what? As long as we maintain our spiritual condition. A couple of places we're reminded that our sobriety is contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I also began to realize that alcohol, the fact that I was drinking myself to death, was indeed a symptom, as were my other addictions, the need to eat gallons of ice cream. Almost anything. I can become addicted. Somebody mentioned Breaking Bad, and I blushed and wanted to hide my face. Binge watching, yikes. So I will take it all in like a vacuum cleaner. Ah, yes. So that was indeed a symptom of something underlying. That by somehow getting deeper and deeper into what this was, realizing that a part of what made me drink, a part of this need to take things in, is a spiritual hunger. And I believe that we're all born with that. We have a deep need to make this conscious contact that Chuck Chamberlain talked about, conscious contact with God, spiritual hunger. And I tried to feed it with alcohol. That worked. And it's no mistake that alcohol is called spirits. It's a spiritual experience until it almost kills me. And it becomes a bad lower power. And yet we have this need. And because I didn't satisfy this spiritual hunger, I searched for many things, and the ego took over, and I went after ambition to be a great scientist. And that became a higher power for a long time. I began to see this, that how my life had been dominated by my self-will, that I can make it right for myself. I can get you to like me. All I have to do is win the Nobel Prize. Then I'll pin it on my shirt and you'll like me. And you'll say, there goes that Nobel Prize winner. I want to get to know her. I want to be her best friend. And I went after that for a lot of years. And I love science. I love everything about it. I love the theory of it. I love labs. I love the fluorescent lights in labs. I love the smell of reagents, the feel and shape of glassware. I love everything about science except for the work part. And that was my downfall. And so I was not very good in the lab. In fact, I broke a lot of glassware and blew up a few things, and people began to move away from me. And then the 60s happened, and I found alcohol to satisfy that deep hunger. And the more I drank, the more I could misbehave. The more I did not pay for the consequences of my behavior, the more defects that I accumulated. I became ever more dishonest. I'd always been kind of sneaky and dishonest. But that was a big defect of my character. And I look back at that. Why did I do that? Why did I tell lies when they weren't even needed? Well, because I felt so bad about myself that I had to make up something. And I'd look at you. There's a speaker out in our part of the country, Evan D., who says, "My higher power was the look on your face." And that's what I do. I just, what do you want me to be? Okay, I'll try to be that. And I was sitting on a bus with somebody and telling that person that I was an undergraduate student, but I had to explain to her that I'd gotten my master's degree in mathematics and my PhD. And she just looked at me and says, "Wow, you look so young." And I just basked in that. And yeah, I know. And for a while, I could live that fantasy as long as I told lies about it. And I had to lie because I felt so terrible myself that the worse I felt about myself, the more exaggerated my lies had to be, so that just while I was telling the lie, I could be that person. I could live in that lie for a while. And so I came into the program still needing to lie to people. I didn't want to tell them about myself because I was such a terrible person. And that was a big one. Did I want to have that one removed? I was afraid to have that one removed because you might know who I am. One to hold on to all of these defects. Yet our seventh step says we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings, all of them. We're entirely ready to have all of these defects removed. Now, some things began to happen. And at first I didn't get the connection. But Marion said, "Say yes to everything." So I began to say yes to everything. I loved Marion. She was my goddess of sobriety. I was staying sober for her approval. I was doing all of those things that were helping me recover. And then she told me, before my first birthday, "I'm moving away." And I said, "Marion, you can't do that." And she said, "Byron took a job in another city. I'm moving." And I said, "Take me with you." And she said, "No. You have to stay here. You have a husband and three children. And they need you." And I said, "Well, at least be my sponsor and I'll call you every day." And she said, "No, Marilyn, you are too intense. You need a sponsor in your home group. You need somebody you see, somebody that sees you." And I said, Marion, I'll get drunk." And she said, no, you won't. The fellowship and God will keep you sober if you work for it." And I said, "But I'll never find another Marion." And she just laughed. Now, I was right about that. I never found another Marion. And that was because I was being weaned off of that tick-like dependency. Seventh step, working in my life. Fiercely dependent on other people. And little by little, those ties have been broken, but not by me. I always attach. And when it's pulled away, my talons come off. I have to grow new ones. And they get a little shorter each time they grow in. And as Marion and Byron moved away, my memory is that I held onto the bumper of the car and I was dragged along I-10, dropped off around Montebello, all bloodied about the chest. Probably didn't happen that way, but that's what it felt like. But the breaking of the dependencies, we can't replace something with nothing. What was happening was that those dependencies then were transferred to a whole constellation of old-timers, to my home group, to the fellowship as a whole, eventually to God as my higher power. Seventh step, working in my life, because I was cooperating with the fellowship. This is a we program, not an I program. That's why we can't take the big book, the 12 and 12, go home, sit in a cave, and recover by ourselves. Our second tradition says our ultimate authority is a loving God who acts in our group conscience. And I believe that God is very present this weekend. It's palpable. It's in the air. And it's not just for AA elections or business meetings. It is God acting in our fellowship with one another. And we never know whether it's us or God talking through us. But one thing I know for sure is that I don't have that direct connection where I just get the word of God and it's always right. It's better to check with my sponsor, because sometimes God sends me a telegram in a foreign language and I need a translation. The one time that I, to digress, noticed that was true, I had had a sort of spiritual awakening where at one point I thought, now it's just me and God. Having taken the third step and the steps that follow, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I thought, now I can just get the direct word. And it was wonderful. I was just, I was an insufferable saint for a while. I mean, I told you about my God and my relationship with my higher power. You too can have what I have. I don't want it, they would think. But I ignored them. And it was me and God. And I was up at Santa Cruz or Big Sur up there on the coast. It was so pretty. And I was standing just communing with my God. And it was so lovely and so beautiful. And I thanked my God. Thank you for making this sunset just for me. And it's wonderful. And then I heard the voice of God so clearly. It said, jump off the cliff. And I thought, from now on, maybe I better check with my sponsor. And that's happened several times in the fellowship where I just feel I sit in prayer and I am big on prayer and meditation and get infused with that power. But when I get advice that's in a concrete form, like pull up stakes and move to Calcutta and turn your life over to Mother Teresa, which I felt that I got one time, it's best to clear it with somebody else. Best to clear it with somebody else. So, as I said, I through interacting with this fellowship, which I feel is absolutely essential, we take the steps, and yet it's a we program. Always doing this with other people, doing it alongside people through whom God speaks to me, I am sure. I read an inventory to my sponsor, and it was on a very important subject. I'd written a fearless and moral inventory about my mother-in-law. And I resented her terribly because in my sick and crazy days when I was drinking so much and had lost my job because of drinking, I was at home. I was supposed to be taking care of my three children, but was giving my life over to alcohol. So my husband had moved his mother in to do the job for us. So you can imagine how I loathed and resented her because she took my place. And by the time I got to the program, I built up a lot of steam about that. And so I had to write all of that in an inventory, just a specific inventory on her. And then was confronted again with the sixth and seventh step. How can I feel good about that resentment? How can I get rid of that resentment? So I talked with Marianne about that. And she said, this is just full of resentment. This is what is causing you so much pain. And I pointed out, but she is so bad. She's the wife of a Lutheran minister, very religious, very proper, and terribly self-righteous. I hated her intolerance of other people, her self-righteousness, and I went raving on about that for some time, and Marianne just sort of sat back and she said, okay, so let's get this straight. You are intolerant of her intolerance, right? You're self-righteous about that. And I had to kind of agree. And so that was the beginning of a long series of steps that brought me into a good relationship with my mother-in-law, thanks to 8 and 9 and a few other things. But again, I began to understand a little bit about intolerance, a little bit about self-righteousness. I can get awfully intolerant about your intolerance, about your negativity. I can get very negative about that. Again, the seventh step, working in my life, God bringing things out to me that I can begin to understand. In our home group, I always felt less than for a long, long time. That's the big Pacific group in West LA where there's lots of very good example. And I always felt kind of like a C-minus member of the group. And yet I had that desperate need for approval. And I made homemade cards for people and homemade gifts. And I was doing that just so that it would be read at a birthday party and everybody would say, ooh, Marilyn Slater made another card. And I was just greedy, greedy for approval, desperate for approval. And party was coming up. It was a third birthday party for a friend, Carol. And that's a party where cards weren't read or gifts weren't open. But I just thought, I've got to do this so they'll like me. And Carol had a great fear of the podium. And so what I did was I fashioned a practice podium. I got this great big cardboard panorama. And I got a little microphone and sat that in the middle of the panorama. And then I took hundreds of magazines and cut out all kinds of faces and glued them all over the cardboard so that she could have a practice podium, microphone, and looking at all those faces. And I even got a bullet. It said, bite the bullet and practice at your practice podium. And I wrapped it up in a great big package. And I thought, oh, they'll never forget Marilyn Slater after that one. Desperate for approval, greedy for their approval. And so I took this big package to the party, and this was one where they weren't opening gifts and reading cards. And I thought, my gosh, what if they don't acknowledge me? And so I began to tell people, I brought a really funny thing. It ought to be opened. And pretty soon I wheedled enough people into saying, okay, Carol, open this one. And she opened it up, and there was the mild, wow. Like, why did you do that? But I was mistaking it for approval. And then our group leader and founder, Clancy, walked over to me, and he looked at me, and he said, the trouble with you is, and I kind of brace when somebody says something like that, the trouble with you is you like group noise too much. Why don't you just try to be a regular alcoholic? Join the ranks. you know, you'll make yourself terminally different, and you'll probably go out and drink and die if you do that. So just join the ranks. Do what everybody else is doing. And I was mortified. Absolutely humiliated. And yet, I stopped making elaborate presents after that. I just gave cards like everybody else was doing. Our book talks about sometimes we gain humility through humiliation. And there's a lot of that in my home group, the Pacific group. Bad dog kind of sponsorship. But I hear that. Sometimes I don't hear the nice things like, oh, you really shouldn't cut in line. But it, bad dog! I step aside. Sorry, excuse me. And again, my character defects coming to the surface, uncovering, discovering, sometimes by somebody else, discarding through this interplay of my willingness to have them removed, plus suffering, public humiliation, and other things. And little by little, I am turned into somebody that kind of passes for normal out in society. When I was in my early years, I was asked to join the PTA because I had young children. And I had just had this sense of, no, I'm not a PTA type person. Just a lot of scorn for that kind of thing. I'm a scientist, I thought of myself. What it was a lot of fear, because those are normal women, and I knew that I was not normal. And yet my sponsor was asking me to join the PTA. So I overcame the fear and stepped into the PTA meeting. And I said, hi, I'm a scientist. And much to my surprise, what seemed to be the big leader of that whole group looked at me and she said, we've been waiting for you. You can be the science chairman. And I then became the science chairman of the elementary school PTA. And I had so much shame about leaving the lab, about being a disappointment. I'd been given a big fellowship, a research project, and people were treating me with respect for a while, and I was just such a flake, squandered an opportunity. So I had a whole lot of guilt and shame about that. And here I was asked to be the science chairman, and because of the way I felt about myself, I thought, I can't do that. This is way above anything I could possibly do. And again, talking with my sponsor said, of course you can do that. Say yes to that. They've been waiting for you, just like she said. So I designed a little chemistry kit, and I used our three children as guinea pigs. If they liked the experiment, it would go into the kit. And if they didn't, then that one would go out. And we worked together on this thing, put it together, and I took it back, and sure enough, the teachers liked it, and I was asked to go out and talk to teachers about how to use this little chemistry kit for, like, first grade, second grade, just elementary stuff. But they seemed to like it, and the first time I had to go out and talk to the science teachers, I just thought, what an order, I can't go through with that. I was quaking in my boots, and Marianne said, of course you can. Again, walking through fear, seventh step, saying yes, just do it. And I kind of got into it, and I talked to the science teachers and worked with them, and it was not so frightening after all. Again, overcoming fear, gaining a little bit of courage by walking through it, by saying yes, being healed in that way, by saying yes. Some of that shame began to disappear, too, especially when I gave a present to Marianne, the lab book that was written up, and it described the experiments, and she thumbed through it, and she said, Marilyn, do you realize that this is the first time in your life that you've done something with your education that might help somebody else? And I thought, wow, she's right. Before that, I had always been a taker. What's in it for me? Never occurred to me to give back. What is that? But Alcoholics Anonymous is give, give back, give and take. We receive and we give, not to the same person, but a give and take kind of thing, being in fellowship with our fellows. And again, a little bit of that shame was removed, a little bit of that guilt. We moved up to San Francisco, and I was more fully conscious, and we were friends with a family that also had three children, and their children were really, really smart. And I began to look at them, and I began to have family envy. We're not like that family. And I looked at our three children, and I thought, it's my fault. They're inferior. And I felt so guilty. And the more I thought about it, the guiltier I felt. And I just really didn't know what to do with that guilt that I felt about the children. It was becoming acute. Envy and guilt, that combination is not good for a good night's sleep. And I went to meetings up there in San Francisco, and there was a guy that took pity on me because I'd come in and cry about guilt at every meeting. And one time he said to me, "Look, I've heard you talk about guilt about your children for a long time. I want to ask you, do you think that God forgives you?" And by that time I'd come to know God and was practicing prayer and meditation. And I thought about that. Does God forgive me? And I looked at him and I said, "No, I don't think so." And he looked at me and he said, "You ruined what I was going to say. I was going to say, how can you be so arrogant? You know that God forgives you. How could you not forgive yourself? You ruined it." And then I felt guilty about him too. And but what was happening was that even though I was trying to make amends to my family, living amends forever, I was looking at my children with this feeling of guilt that I have somehow ruined their lives and poisoned them so that we're not like that superior family. And who knows whether that family was superior. It was my perception, and my perception has always been so distorted. And yet I just was clouded by looking at them. And so, therefore, I would get the children to try to make them into what I thought that they would be so that nobody could blame me for being a bad mom. So when David wanted to go out and play baseball, I'd say, "No, you must sit here and do your math homework, because then you will be the best person in your math class." And they will say, "Oh, he probably has a good mom." Becky wanted to play the guitar. And I said, "No, you should play the cello, like Yo-Yo Ma, or whoever was the cellist at the time. Because if she played the guitar, they might think, rock and roll, she probably has a terrible mom. But if she played the cello, oh, she must have a wonderful mom." And so Becky would saw away and look unhappy. And so the children were actually suffering because of my intense care for them to make them into what I thought would get the approval of whoever. So I kept watching them. And we were living next door to a school, the Los Amigos School in San Francisco, and it was for children with very special needs, some who could maybe have a mental age of 2 or 3, children that were having a lot of difficulty with motor control, and just very special needs kids. And they played in the play yard, and they seemed to be happy, and I didn't pay too much attention to it, but was aware of it. But what I was aware of is that we could go use the play yard after school hours. And one night I was over there with our three children, and a car drove up, and it was a mom with her little boy. And he had a lot of challenges. He had great difficulty walking and speaking, but she got him over to a swing, and she strapped him into one of the special swings and began swinging him. And I was watching that, and I was watching them laugh, looking at each other with pure joy. And I saw mom looking at her son, perfect son that she loved very much, and I saw him looking at his perfect mom, perfect love passing between them. And the light was on their faces, and I got it. God gave me that snapshot. And I looked at Becky, David, and Susie, and I saw the light on their faces, and I saw them as perfect children of God, just as they are, growing into whatever God put them on earth to be, if I would get out of the way. And I said, let's go home. Let's go home and play. And we grew up together after that, had a much lighter hand after that. And that was one of those instances where something was removed very quickly with a lot of preparation. I had to do it wrong, but just was willing to have that guilt removed. And then in an instant with the snapshot, I saw it. I saw what my higher power was trying to tell me. And we did a lot of mountain climbing after that, and my son became an elite rock climber, and I had a lot of pleasant days climbing with him, thanking God for freeing me up to enjoy my family. And our two daughters grew up and produced a whole bunch of children. Only five, but it seems like a lot. And again, God working in my life to free me up to enjoy life, to enjoy life. I somewhere along the way made amends to the director of the lab. I was asked to go back to work in that lab where I drank all the beer, and just was such a flake. And I don't know how that happened. Probably pity on the director's part. But I went back and again had to go back with all the shame and guilt that I felt to walk through a situation and try to be a little bit better. In sobriety, I still wasn't a very good scientist in the lab. I continued to break glassware. I am just such a klutz. But went back to school and got a degree in medical informatics is what it was called, so I can be near science and not have to break anything or blow up anything. And before, when I was on the decline, I had no coping power but to drop out and drink a lot, drown my shame and guilt. But in sobriety, finding that, hey, I've been put on earth to do something besides lab science, got to find what that is. Our book tells us we're to be of maximum service. We're supposed to find whatever God put us on earth to do and do it. And I had to sort through that, go back to school, and then learn something so that I can be of maximum service. This time when I went to school, it was just a very different thing. I was no longer going to school to try to get a degree or a Nobel Prize so I could put it on my shirt so that you would think, okay, you are a good person. It was just, that seems to be where my path has led me, and I'm supposed to learn something so that I can pay back in some kind of way and use whatever talent I was put on earth to have for maximum service. And I've been working in that profession for a long time, and then in these last years, for the last 10 or 12 years, I've been a part of a lifelong learning institute that was a part of UCLA for a long time. Now we're independent, but we teach courses for lifetime learners, people who just love to learn about stuff. Now, there aren't many people like that, but those few, we serve that group. And I get to teach the science courses, and it's been a happy reunion because I came into the program with a lot of scorn for anything supernatural because I believed in the great God Science. And then, having had a spiritual awakening on this program, I began to see that the universe is much more complex than I ever had imagined. And I will never understand in this lifetime what it's all about. And now I approach science as another picture of the majesty of God, the magnificence of God. I mean, the universe is very big, lots of stars, lots of galaxies, really huge. And anything that permeates the whole universe is the ground of all being. That demands a lot of respect. Just like Chuck Chamberlain radiated something very big, something very complex. But in addition to that, infinite love, infinite energy for us pitiful alcoholics. The more pitiful we are, the more God seems to love us, the more attention we get. And I began to have that greater appreciation for both God and science because of the synergy of the two. A couple of speakers have alluded to the fact that we have to take these steps continuously. And Karen, in her wonderful talk, said, you don't know when the bottom's going to drop out. You take the steps, you get involved in the program, you stay involved. And that's just putting a little bit of sobriety in the bank, just kind of building up that sobriety bank account. Most of the time we don't need the full extent of it, but we just do it. And I do it because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think about it in that way so much as, this is my life, this is my sustenance. But it is very much like buckling a seatbelt. And you do that before the crash, because as you're driving down and a truck swerves in front of you and you crash into it, you just usually don't have a whole lot of time to get that seatbelt around your shoulder and into the clasp. You want to have that done ahead of time. And that was a thing that I came to understand in a profound way because, as some of you know, 3.5 years ago, our beloved son took his own life. And I don't think we'll ever know why that happened. He was not an alcoholic. It could be that he did not have the kind of relief that I had from alcohol. And maybe he had some of the same emotions, but didn't show them. It was a surprise to all of us. And one day we had our wonderful son, and the next day he was gone. When that happened, I needed to have my seatbelt on, and I needed my 40 years of sobriety, and I needed that full commitment, having worked all of the steps. I needed it all in that moment. I also needed the thousands of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that came to my rescue. I needed it all. And one of the most important persons at that time was Sandy Beach, because he had lost his two daughters the year before, one to our disease and one was murdered in a front yard. And he told me what he did, because he was speaking at our home group shortly before we lost David. And I was out of town. I was at the State Line Convention when this happened, when I got the news. And so I had to drive home back from Las Vegas to Los Angeles because I got the word at 11 o'clock at night. And as I drove home on that dark drive, 7-hour drive to Los Angeles, I had one CD in the car that I could listen to, and it just happened to be Sandy Beach. And he told the story of losing his two daughters, and he said that if you're ever in that situation, I'm going to tell you precisely what I did. You have a little bit of time to react, he said, when you get news like that. And what you do is you go out to God, to your higher power, and you say, I'm not going to abandon you. Please don't abandon me. And you form that contract again as never before. And so I listened to that and I practiced that on that drive. I said to my higher power, please don't leave me. I need you. I need you now as never before. And then I'd listen to the CD again. And I knew I had to go home to Bill, who was at home with that kind of news. And that was exactly what I needed on that way back. God giving me 100% attention, I felt like. And when I got home, my job then was to comfort Bill, who doesn't have the kind of program that I have. And then I began to get phone calls, God taking care of me. Julie St. J., who had lost her son 10 years before, is sponsored by my best friend, and she called. And she had that advice. She said, Marilyn, you won't believe this, but right now I'm going to tell you, accept what is happening, and then begin to look for the gifts. And I know you can't believe it now, and I couldn't. What gifts could come? What joy could there ever be after losing a child, especially in that way? And yet I turned myself over to Alcoholics Anonymous one more time, and its healing power. And then one more time, that guilt that I felt had been gone forever came back. What did I do that would cause this to happen? And I was riddled with guilt. That is the one thing that suicide can do, is make just about everybody feel guilty, but a mom especially. And again, I was sleepless about what could it have been? How could I have stopped this? I had talked to him days before, and what did I miss? What did I not hear? And was plagued with that. And likewise, his younger sister, Susie, who adored her big brother, was feeling guilt. And his young widow, Erin, was feeling guilt. What did she miss? And we began to talk with one another. And I could look at Susie and I could look at Erin. I realized that that was false guilt, that they loved David. And they're blameless. But they looked at me and they had the same feeling. They said, you only love David. And we realized in sharing that with one another that the guilt was misplaced, that as my first sponsor, Marion, had reminded me, guilt is a selfish pastime. Get up and do whatever you can. And at first, we just, through a little ritual, the three of us were sitting together talking about David and our feelings about him, guilt that we felt. And we just looked at one another and said, let's all forgive one another. And we held hands and we just looked at one another. I forgive you. I forgive you. God forgives you. And just through that little act, maybe we were guilty, but we forgave one another. Whatever we do, we have to accept that there is a loving God that forgives us. And as my friend back in San Francisco told me a long time ago, how can we be so arrogant that we can't forgive ourselves if God forgives us? And so I accepted that forgiveness and then realized that I have a job now. I'm in a circle that you'd never want to enter. Loss of a child, survivor of a suicide. And because that's true, women come into my life when I talk, and they are entering that circle. And I take their hand and I say, come in, it's safe. It is safe in here. Let me tell you my story. 3.5 years have passed, and Julie was right. I missed David terribly, but there is joy in my life. My life has filled up. And I realized that now my mission is to share this story with other people and say, it is safe. It is safe beyond the unthinkable. And in doing that too, I have said yes to life and was elected president of this Lifelong Learning Institute. Maybe God's sense of humor or God keeping me busy. But I don't think I've ever worked so hard in my life. And I don't think I've ever had so much fun working. And I'm just astonished constantly that my life is full of joy now. As the wonderful Hillary in her music sang, "The best is yet to be." There's a poet, Browning, who said, "Grow old along with me. The best is yet to be, the last of life for which the first was made. All of our experiences, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, contributes to this good life that we have." It tells us that indeed the best is yet to be. Thank you.